Mark found the accounts of the old man's estate filed with the Master of the Court, almost contemptuously, under the heading, Intestate Estates Less Than £100. On the credit side were listed 2 rifles and a shotgun, 4 trek oxen and a Scotch cart, sold at public auction to realise £84.16. On the debit side were legal and commission fees accruing to one Dennis Peterson and costs of winding up the state. The total was £127. The account had been in deficit. A distribution had been made and the estate closed. John Archibald Anders had gone and left hardly a ripple behind him, not even the £3,000 he had been paid for Anders' land. Mark hefted his pack again and went out into the brilliant sunlight of afternoon. A water cart was moving slowly down Main Street, drawn by 2 oxen, its sprinklers pouring fine jets of water into the roadway to lay the thick dust. Mark paused and inhaled the smell of water on dry earth, and looked across the street at the towering building of the Ladyburg Farmers Bank. For a brief moment, he touched the idea of crossing and entering, demanding of the men in there what had made the old man change his firm resolve to die and be buried on Anders' land, how the money had been paid to him, and what he had done with it. But the idea passed swiftly. The men who worked in that building were creatures of a different breed from the penniless grandson of an illiterate hard-scrabble farmer. There were orders in society, unseen barriers which a man could not cross, even if he had a university diploma, a military medal for gallantry, and an honourable discharge from the army. That building was the shrine of wealth and power and influence, where dwelt men like giants, like gods. The likes of Mark Anders did not barge in there demanding answers to unimportant questions about an old man of no account. Intestate estate less than £100, Mark whispered aloud, and set off across town towards the clanking, huffing sounds of the railway goods yard. Yes, agreed the station master. Piet Greling was a mainline loco driver, and his son fired for him. But they threw in their time months ago, back in 1919, both of them. He rubbed his chin thoughtfully. No, I don't know where they were headed. They're just too damned happy to see them go, I guess. Oh, yes, now I come to think of it, the son did say something about going up to Rhodesia, going to buy a farm or something. And the man chuckled. Buy a farm? With what, I wonder? Wishes and dreams. Not on the salary of a loco driver or fireman. The boardroom of the Ladyburg Farmers Bank occupied half of the top floor of the building. One set of floor-to-ceiling windows faced eastwards to catch the cool sea breeze on hot summer days. The other windows faced the tall escarpment. This made a fine backdrop to the town and gave an interesting aspect to the huge room with its high, ornately plastered ceiling, where dancing white cherubs bearing bunches of grapes were suspended upside down, frozen in their endless jollification. The walls were panelled in dark mahogany that set off the green velvet curtaining with golden corded edges. The carpet was green also, and thick enough to muffle the hooves of a cavalry charge. The boardroom table was of marble, with golden ormolu work, vine leaves and nude female figures clambering up the legs, playing harps or dancing demurely. At one end of the table a man stood respectfully, a man with the short neck and heavy shoulders of a wrestler. The seat of his khaki breeches was shiny from the saddle, and his boots were dusty from hard riding. He twisted the rim of a slouch hat nervously between his fingers. Opposite where he stood at the far end of the marble table, another man slouched elegantly in the leather-padded chair. Even seated, it was clear that he was a big man. The shoulders under the expensive British broadcloth were wide and powerful. However, his head was nicely balanced on these shoulders, a glorious head of lustrous but skilfully barbered hair, dark curls that extended low down onto his cheeks into magnificent sideboards. The strong, smoothly shaven chin had the jut and set of a man accustomed to command, a wide, determined mouth and perfect white teeth, with which he now nibbled thoughtfully at his lower lip. A small frown formed a bird's foot at the bridge of his nose, between the dark, intelligent eyes, and one carefully manicured fist supported his chin as he listened quietly. "Anyway, I thought you might like to know, Mr. Courtney," the speaker ended lamely, and shuffled his dusty boots on the thick carpet. For a long moment there was silence. The man glanced uneasily at the other two gentlemen who flanked Dirk Courtney, but then flicked back to the central figure. Dirk Courtney dropped his hand into his lap, and the frown cleared. "I suspect you did the right thing, Hobday." He smiled slightly, a smile that enhanced his powerful good looks. "You can rest in the antechamber. The clerk there will find refreshment for you, but I will want to talk to you again later. Wait."
"Yes, sir, Mr. Courtney, sir."
The man crossed to the door with alacrity, and as it closed behind him, the two men flanking Dirk Courtney burst out together.
"I told you at the time something like this would happen. But you told us he'd been killed. I never liked the idea. I just thought it was going too far this time."
They spoke across each other, quick, breathless outbursts, while Dirk Courtney sat with an enigmatic half-smile hovering on his lips, examining with attention the diamond on the little finger of his right hand, turning the big white stone to catch the light from the windows so that it flicked spots of brilliant light across the ceiling high above where he sat. After a few minutes, the two of them faltered into silence, and Dirk Courtney looked up politely.
"Have you both finished? I found that most helpful, constructive and imaginative."
He looked from one to the other expectantly, and then when they were silent, he went on.
"Unfortunately, you're not in possession of all the facts. Here is some more news for you. He arrived in town this morning, and he went straight to the land deeds, from there to the register of companies, the master's office."
There was a fresh outburst of lamentation from his listeners, while Dirk Courtney selected a cigar from the humidor and prepared it carefully, cutting the end with a gold-plated pocket knife and moistening it between his lips. Then he held it poised between thumb and forefinger while he waited for silence again.
"Thank you, gentlemen. But as I was saying, the gentleman in question then went down to the goods yard and began making inquiries about Hreilung and son."
This time they were silent, exchanging appalled and disbelieving glances. And the silence drew out while Dirk Courtney struck a swan vesta and waited for the sulphur to burn off before he lit the cigar.
"It was all your idea," said Ronald Pye.
He was at least 30 years senior to Dirk Courtney. Once prosperously bulging flesh had sagged beneath his expensive waistcoat. His jowls drooped also like the wattles of a rooster, and his cheeks were mottled with faded freckles and old man's blemishes, little darker liver spots. His hair also had faded and thinned, stained only by residual traces of the fiery ginger it had once been. But his prominent ears stood out from his head, giving him an alert listening look like a desert fox, and his eyes had a fox's cunning glitter as they watched Dirk Courtney's face.
"Yes," Dirk Courtney agreed. "Most ideas around here are mine indeed. That's why the net reserves of the Farmers' Bank have increased from 1.5 to £15 million in the 10 years since I started contributing my ideas."
Ronnie Pye went on staring at him, regretting bitterly for the 10,000th time in those 10 years that he had ever been tempted to sell control of the bank to this young adventurer, this elegant buccaneer. God knows there had been occasion for doubt, for caution, and he had hesitated long enough before accepting the fantastic offer that Dirk Courtney had made. He had known too much of the lad's history, how he had left his home here in Ladyburg in unsavoury circumstances, estranged from his father and family. Then, years later, he had sauntered into Ronald Pye's office, unannounced and unheralded, and made his offer. He had seen at a glance that the boy had grown into a hard man, but the offer had been too good to miss. And then, immediately after, he had begun to hear the dark rumours that followed the man, as vultures follow the lion. He should have been warned. The fact that Dirk Courtney could offer £600,000 in cash for 60% of the bank's shares and support the offer with a bank guarantee from Lloyds Bank of London was in itself enough to give substance to the dark rumours. How often does an honest man make that kind of money in a few short years, he asked himself. In the end, the money had tempted Ronnie Pye, that and the chance to score over an old enemy, General Sean Courtney. He had delighted in the prospect of setting up the estranged son, setting him up in almost baronial circumstances in the very centre of the Courtney country. The delight in doing so had swung the balance, spite, and £600,000 cash money. It had been a bad bargain.
"I was against this from the beginning," he said now. My dear Pye, you were against every new idea on principle. Yet only a week ago you were swooning like a virgin bride over the balance sheet of Ladyburg Estates and Zululand Sugar.
Dirk stood up from the chair.
His full height was imposing. He smoothed his hair lightly with both hands, while his cigar was gripped between strong white teeth. Then he arranged the folds of his cravat, touching the pearl pin before swinging away and striding to the far wall of the boardroom. He drew down the rolled map of Zululand and North Natal that covered half the wall, and stood back from it. The boundary of every farm was marked in large-scale topography. The farms belonging to Ladyburg Estates had been carefully shaded in green chalk. They made an impressive sweep of colour, from sea to mountains, a great phalanx of land and natural wealth.
"There it is now, gentlemen, the scheme that you opposed so violently."
He smiled again.
"It was too rich for your watery blood." The smile faded and he scowled. When he scowled, the line of the wide mouth became bitter, and the set of the lustrous eyes altered with a mean, pinched expression. "The key to the whole thing was here on the Umfolozi. The water. We had to have it, or none of it made sense. One stupid, stubborn, uneducated old bastard."
He cut it off abruptly, and in a moment his smile was back, the voice tight with excitement.
"It's all ours now, the full south bank of the river, and it's not going to end there."
His spread hands clamped down on the map, hooked like claws.
"Here," he said, "and here, and here."
His hands marched northwards greedily. He swung away from the map, laughing, and cocked his big, handsome head at them.
"Look at you," he laughed. "It's running down your legs, you're so terrified, and all because I'm making you rich."
Dennis Peterson spoke now. He was the same age as Ronnie Pye, married to his sister. And but for that connection, he would never have been seated at the Ormolu marble table, for he was the least significant of the three men. His features were indefinite and slightly blurred. His body in expensive clothing was pudgy and shapeless, while the colour of his eyes was difficult to fathom.
"What are we going to do?" he asked,
and though his hands were clasped in his lap, it seemed that he was actually wringing them plaintively.
"We?" Dirk asked kindly and crossed to his chair. "We, my dear Dennis?"
He patted the man's shoulder like a father, despite the age difference.
"We aren't going to do a thing. You just go back to your office now, and I will tell you about it once it's over."
"Listen, Dirk," Dennis lifted his chin firmly, "no more of that rough stuff, do you hear?" Then he saw Dirk's eyes and dropped his chin.
"Please," he mumbled.
Dirk chuckled.
"Off you go. Off you go and do your sums, both of you. Add up the money. Don't worry about a thing."
He helped them from their seats, a hand on each shoulder, and shepherded them towards the door.
"We have a board meeting tomorrow at 9 o'clock, Dennis. I'll be discussing the new extraction plant at Stanger. I will want the figures. Make sure I have them."
Alone for a moment, Dirk Courtney's face changed and the eyes narrowed. He pressed out the stub of the cigar in the onyx ashtray as he crossed to the door that led to the antechamber.
"Obday," he called softly. "Come in here a moment, please."